the directors of Little Miss Sunshine, who apparently he went to their house and practiced.
Oh, really?
I talked to him a little bit afterwards. Sure, I had not met them before. So
it's hot up here.
It is.
Is it another 98 degree scorcher today, or what's the deal?
I don't know.
Would you hear on that?
I haven't heard. I just take it as it comes. What are you going to do?
So this is it. This is the future. This is the day the Earth comes alive. This is climate change. This is China, India.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I'm totally fine with water and maybe a cup of coffee if you can possibly.
Black coffee.
Very strong black coffee.
This is vine.
So I think that the big metaphor you'll pull out is that you can cruise along and struggle along as a producer. And then, just like that, when life allows it, or you will it, you can suddenly be a really gifted director. And probably every producer in town will say, why am I not doing this? Or why haven't I done this? What prevented you from trying to be the gifted director in your 20s or 30s?
Well, you know, that's what I started off being, was a director, writer-director, and we did the first, you know, it's what I always wanted to do. I wrote kind of scripts in my spare time when I got out of college and was working in an ad agency and things like that. And then finally put together a company with a couple other guys in Minneapolis to try to do a film out of there. Did one, but I didn't want to move to Los Angeles. It wasn't a huge success, but you know, got distribution and all that. But it wasn't something that I chose not to move at that time, so I stayed in Minneapolis trying to get the next one going. And did documentary work for a while, and it just, you know, 1 year turned into 10, and then you go, I'm not doing any closer to doing another feature, so I decided to shift away and pretend I was a producer, really, you know, kind of use whatever business sense I had and let that lead the way. And,
well, obviously a good business sense, but that's the impact you made as the connected producer.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was way around.
But I've never, you know, on the other hand, you know, I'm not a traditional producer in a lot of ways, and that I'm not a super networker kind of like schmoozy guy.
Living in Minnesota.
And I was out here a lot. It's just not my nature to kind of have like a million different connections and try to have a million different projects going.
Right.
Everything pretty much came from personal relationships and all that. And I feel like the films I chose and the people that I worked with was more kind of about the creative side, like it was my creative outlet versus, you know, me being a super great businessman or something like that, or a super great producer.
No, X Factor producer. I never thought of you as a business guy, but you're a...
But, you know, working with, you know, people, whether I had the right to or not, you know, Sean and Terry and people like that I built relationships with, I wasn't shy about saying what I thought, whether they ever listened to me or not. But creatively, I wasn't shy about doing that.
Did you ever try to tell Terrence Malick anything?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, we screened. I mean, we watched Tree of Life a million times together, and I would give notes every time. I was not shy about that. And he was nice enough to, you know, and he would probably say that he made some changes. Whether he did or he didn't, it was just a good relationship, but it was part of my outlet. You know, that was what I did versus, you know, necessarily doing all the deals and all that kind of thing. So, and I, you know, but then eventually I felt like I had done enough to warrant or me going back to what I originally loved, which was directing.
But your love and mercy doesn't look, feel like a film in which someone is taking a good first stab. And it's really, you know, not an exceptionally good film. And it's not, it's like something that a director who's been at it for a long time would have made, as opposed to somebody who's been.
Yeah, I can't explain that. I maybe I was a director the whole time in my head, and I was playing out things in my head that weren't necessarily coming out, you know, in the things we were doing. But I felt, I can't tell you exactly why. I know that, like, my wife and everything, you know, you just, people who know you, suddenly, it, when I was in the situation of actually directing the movie, it didn't seem like a leap to me. It seemed very comfortable, and it wasn't like, oh my God, am I gonna, it was just like, you know, doing the job. And then she would, you know, she said, and a lot of people I know say, you know, like, you're a different person suddenly. It's like, you know, whatever, it feels like that's where you were meant to be or whatever. And whatever, I don't know if that's the case. All I know is that that's what I wanted to do. That's what I, how I always felt, and that's how it felt actually stepping back into the position.
So is there a 2.5 or a 3-hour cut that you were pretty happy with?
No, no, I'm pretty, I don't know, pragmatic is the word or whatever. I mean, you know, I hated to lose certain scenes for sure. But they were all very good reasons. Like we had, you know, the scene, one of the deleted scenes on the DVD is scene 11, which was, you know, our recreation of an incident that happened when Murray, Brian's father, came into the studio one time and broke up a recording session. He was kind of drunk, and you know, it's on YouTube. Like, you can hear the actual words of Murray coming in and all that, and we recreated that, and it was a great scene. But it said too much too early in the movie about who everybody was, and it almost like took away any arc, because it was just like there.
Interesting that Don was, when he talked to their mother, he didn't touch Murray at all in that movie.
Yeah.
He was just very quiet.
I'm sure she probably didn't want to or whatever. Those are all those situations, you know.
She's not with us.
No, she died way before, I don't know, which is probably, I don't think she died that long after Don Was's documentary was done. So I never, yeah, Carl or any of those guys I never got close to, and never, you know, close to even.
You know, for whatever reason, I didn't read David Thompson's really fan piece about Elizabeth. And she basically says that she plays a kind of rescuer in the vein of Cary Grant at the end of Notorious. And that, you know, the overwhelming feeling that was, every time, I've seen it 6 times, but every time you see it, it's basically, there isn't a villain, there's 3 villains. 3 villains against a guy who isn't that good defending himself in the first place.
Yeah.
And just kind of going, can you leave me alone, let me do the thing? And then, well, no, we want to be villains and make your life a little better. You know, Murray, Mike Love, and of course Eugene.
Pretty
heavily stacked on.
You know, and everybody, you want to understand everybody, like why they did the things they did. Otherwise, they're just like, there's no reason to have them in the movie if you can't somehow present them in a rounded fashion, you know, just to put up a cardboard, one-dimensional villain. And I probably, we've talked about this before, probably, you know, with Landy, it was more difficult than Mike or Murray. Because with Mike and Murray, you can kind of see where they were coming from. Not that I agree necessarily, but you can kind of see the humanity of Mike. I mean, he's just a different kind of guy. You know, I've heard a lot of stories over the years. You know, in the media, he's presented as a really bad, whatever. And he may be a difficult personality, I guess. But he's also just a different guy. We're celebrating Brian's creativity here. It's a movie about this great genius. But there's the other side of the coin, which is just like Mike Love, who just wants to do his job. He's not interested in creating or breaking new ground. He just wants to do his job, and now this guy's messing it up. It's kind of like, hey, would you stop doing that? Let's just do what we were doing.
You know, in today's realm, if a, say, the prime genius music maker like Brian wanted to make music that was sort of away from the brand or the sound, they would just say, well, let's do a separate album, and then we'll just keep the brand going, but this will be 2 tracks.
Yeah.
Did you ever ask, why don't they just simply do that? Not get so upset about this, you're fucking with a brand, we can't do smile.
Well, because they needed him, obviously. You know, they needed him. It wasn't, and if he went off and did something on there was all that insecurity. It's not just their fault for being insecure, being on their own without Brian, but it's also his insecurity. As much as he's a creative genius, he wants approval.
Right.
He wants approval from his dad. It doesn't matter how, you know, it's typical of all human situations, like, you know, abusive parents or something like that. It doesn't mean that kids suddenly don't want their approval. They still want it, no matter how bad it gets, because it's like, you know, something built into us. And I think that's what's going on with Brian. So, I mean, even Landy, who was, like, really pretty awful to Brian. You know, we were kind to Landy relative to a lot of the stories that I've heard from Brian and other people. But yet, still wanted his approval at that point. He needed.
The Landy years were specifically from 82? I know he was in earlier, but the real Landy.
Yeah, he was there for like a year, and he made a lot of progress, and then they fired him, and then like, I think 2 years later, they... I'm terrible with numbers, so I'll have to remember.
9 years, 10 years?
Yeah,
like
yeah, right, yeah.
And he was finally out as of 90, I think, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so, but you know, there was that period too where he gave up his license to practice and all that, and he no longer treated Brian, but he managed him. You know,
yeah.
Brian still wanted him to manage him because it just that is so classic of those human situations where you want to believe that it's all very clean cut so we can understand it. Yet, in reality, people aren't that. You know, it's like the abuse thing or whatever. It's hard to let go when you're relying on people for certain things.
I think I may have told you that I had a little run in Brian way back in 74.
Yeah.
I was personally at the time kind of a fall of how he looked.
Uh-huh.
And he, being the sensitive soul that he is, he read my expression. And he kind of went, oh, I don't want to be around this guy. He's giving me the wrong vibes. I didn't mean to convey anything, but obviously it was coming through.
Yeah.
And I was as a Hollywood Reporter in 84, and I went to a Beach Boys concert at the Universal Amphitheater. And Brian came out and was thinking, look at him. He's trim and he's clean and he sang a song, this really great song, The Boogie's Back in Town. And I was thinking, wow, there's something pretty good happening here, obviously. So that was my impression of Lane until after I read the story.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't altogether bad thing in a certain sense. He was running, he was looking.
Yeah,
good,
absolutely. You know? That first stint, he really did great. But then I think, you know, the
abuse,
and the power starts to go to your head and you start to do things that clearly out of line because you feel like, you've got to, I mean, think. I don't claim to totally understand Landy. I feel like I kind of understand Murray and Mike, but Landy, I don't quite get it. Although the fact that like he managed George Benson for a while, you know, before he became like a doctor and all that. You know, you could tell he's one of those guys who maybe like Murray wanted to be famous or wanted to be Brian Wilson. He wanted to be that kind of guy himself and it didn't happen for him. So then he kept trying to connect with people and make himself part of their world. And then when he got in his hooks in Brian, it was like, okay, now I can start writing music and producing and all that kind of thing. I can be Brian, kind of take over his life. So I don't know. I don't know if that's overly simplistic, but that seems like what's going on. I don't totally understand what got him to that point and what else was going on in his life, but that part of it feels believable. But it's he was a tough one to capture, and obviously having Paul Giamatti to round it out was a nice thing.
You know, it's like with the Coens, we were talking the other night with some friends, that there's a... talking about this with a director friend, that there's a pretty small but very devoted sector of the viewing public that worships Joel and Ethan Coen, pretty much anything they do, watch their films over and over again, own them, the whole thing. Maybe 80% of the general viewing public is like, that's it. That's as far as they go. They can't get into it. You know?
Yeah.
Inside Llewyn Davis, they wouldn't touch it. It's like 20% of the people I know that are real film lovers worship Lovecraft. And obviously it didn't do enough, you know, the first thing. It should have done, like, a lot more, but it didn't. Yeah. And I was just like, you know, I'm just glad it's on Blu-ray. I'm glad it's streaming.
Me too. The more people we can get to see it now, the better. You know, there's I don't know if you heard, but there's this thing, the Mental Health Organization. Have you heard about this? Campaign to change direction.
White House.
Yeah, which is kind of cool. I mean, that's one of those things where, I mean, yes, first of all, overall, yes, I would like more people to see the movie. And because it does, like you say, it feels like, even now, of all the films I've done, I mean, the people that come up to me that are really passionate, and they don't seem to be just saying it because, you know, they've run into me or something like that. It's like they seek me out or whatever. It's like, that was a great movie. I love that movie.
Yeah.
You know, even on, you know, the other movies you've done, Harvest Slavery, whatever, I didn't get that kind of just widespread. Not that I'm not comparing the two, just like, wow. So just want more people to see it is all. I can't quite figure out, like you, maybe why it didn't break through. You know, they're like, well, you know, it will on DVD because, you know, people don't go to the movies, and maybe it's an older crowd and it's harder to get them in the movies. I don't know. But I mean, like, I don't know if it's still showing in Minneapolis, but like there's a theater and people are still going, like, and so it does take a while for, you know, a certain crowd to get out there and see it. So I don't know. I wish I understood all that stuff better and could.
I've told you that I'm a huge fan. Of what made me feel immensely relaxed and expectant of this film, the very first thing, the 16mm footage with Paul. And I'm not thinking, what else was shot on 16 in that kind of random, kind of like you just happen to be there and somebody turned on the camera fashion? Is there something else in the film that I'm missing? Because much of it is pretty well ordered and it doesn't look 16mm-ish.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, everything in the studio is 16.
It's 16,
yeah.
Okay.
Everything, like in the studio in the 60s, we literally cut it off at the door of the studio. So if they broke the wall of the studio, they would go. It would go to 35.
Okay.
Except for, in addition to the beach stuff and Beach Boys stuff, and also I think Surf's Up. I think it's shot on 16. Paul at the piano playing Surf's Up.
Oh, that was nice.
I think.
Yeah.
And then So, but everything in the studio is 16. So, and that was a decision, you know, obviously, to try to find a way to not hit it over the head, you know, but to give it a different feel. I mean, because obviously, you know, with the two time periods, or really three time periods, there was an opportunity to, or a possibility to really make it different. But it seemed like you don't want to go too far with that. It then becomes like the center of attention, and you know, there was enough going on with wardrobe and hairstyles and all that that would give you, and plus, you know, Paul and John would delineate those that you'd never be confused where you were.
So, when I first talked to you about Love and Mercy and Telluride, was Roadside the distributor at that point?
No.
They got it well after?
Right after.
So right after.
I mean, so there was Telluride, and then we went to Toronto, and then, you know,
So the question is, after I saw it, why did this open at Telluride? It's a perfect Telluride job.
No, because the issue was that whole thing about Toronto, that we really needed to sell the film because we had not, and at that time, like, we wanted to be in the opening weekend, or that's what everybody was telling me.
You would have been bumped if you had gone to Tiger.
Yeah, to Monday or Tuesday or sometime in the week. So whatever, you know, in a lot of cases you try to follow the lead of the marketing and CAA and all of your advisors on it. That was the, and then, you know, as you know, because you were right in it, the whole decision about going right away or waiting. Who knows? I mean, you got to just believe and then work too. Obviously, we're in a position of having to work a little harder now because it was released in June. And if it had been released more recently, we wouldn't have worked so hard. But whatever. Yeah, I don't want to belabor that kind of stuff. You want to just do the best you can.
Throwing in that little beginning with Paul, is that something that occurred to you somewhere in the editing, let's just be a little crazy and throw that in.
I love that part, that part of the edit process where things like that come in. It was always, it was scripted that you'd start at the beginning in his room, the bed and all that stuff. And then you would go to the black hole, and then into the credit. This other piece was something we had shot for a scene that was further into the film during the making of Petzl. It wasn't that long, but as soon as we tried that, I'm trying to remember exactly how it came up as an idea. But, you're just kind of looking for this, something's missing, You kind of don't know exactly what it is, but something's missing from the front of it. Because I love the beginning of movies. I always like them to be kind of grabbers in some way. And felt missing, so we tried that, and it just kind of clicked to me. It was like, bang.
Where did the idea for the clattering plates and silver?
That was scripted.
Where did Orin get that?
We had talked about from the beginning the whole thing about trying to understand what Brian goes through and what he hears. Both the black hole and the fork, knives and forks, we called it, is all part of that, trying to let the audience hear what he hears. There was one other, getting into the minutiae of it, but where Paul is laying on the car, outside the studio, and he hears
lying down.
And he hears that. That is probably one thing that if I had anything I could change in the movie, would be to expand that slightly, so that it was a little more clear what was going on. That he just hears this stuff all the time. Sometimes it's beautiful, and sometimes it's like awful. So.
Series of Beach Boys fans, you're totally into the non-vocal, pure instrumental tracks. They are magnificent.
I agree.
That is totally the way to get his genius. It's not just the, everybody thinks of the vocals, obviously. I love listening to it.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, and throughout pre-production and stuff, I would just listen endlessly to Pet Sounds, the sessions, where you could just hear, just listen to that continuous flow of Brian working in the studio and stopping and starting, and other people maybe would find it just kind of really boring, but I think it's incredibly beautiful just to hear certain tracks play out as a whole, or combination of tracks. So. Pretty cool.
Getting off for a second, do you think that, at this point, I presume your relationship with Malik continues. So apparently he keeps delaying and he can't get these films made. The feeling is that he's being enabled, indulged by people who are back in the old days, Bert Schneider used to read the riot act to him and help him get it in shape. And it's like, is he going to wait until 2017 and make these movies?
I mean, I don't know.
Have you seen the other one?
Which one?
The one that we have not. We've all that they saw.
Night of Cups, or which one?
Night of Cups in Berlin, and that's next year, I think, spring. But the other one, which was called Lawless, and is now called.
I can't remember what it's called. But I mean,
he started shooting that in 2011.
I know. But I mean, I really love Terry. He's a great guy. And the thing about him is he's super true, or sincere, or authentic. A lot of other people in the business do things for some reason, like to make people crazy, or to do this, or to do that.
Yeah.
I guarantee Terry does not do that. He's just marching to his own drummer, literally. And you could say, well, somebody needs to, crack the whip or something like that. But, whatever. We worked very closely together on Tree of Life. And, yes, if I had my way, there would be things I would do differently, or he would have done differently. But on the other hand, this guy's he's a true artist in my mind. There's a lot of people in the business who are just posing. They're either craftspeople and posing as artists, artists or whatever. They're simply, you know, posers. He's truly an artist. Like, he's actually on an emotional journey or an artistic emotion that's wrapped up with his emotions to find some, like, new ways of telling stories and things like that. He's not trying to confound us, not trying to do the next cool thing. He's literally doing it, like, the way it should be done from the heart. Right. It may drive people crazy, but, and maybe you could argue that he should be disciplined and somebody should crack the whip, but, you know.
The way a producer is supposed to act.
Yeah.
You know, like, come on, man.
I mean, I did that.
You know, but I'm telling you.
I did that. I guarantee you. There was a lot of that. You know, we did not, like, pussyfoot around. I mean, it was him and me, and we would have whatever, not yelling arguments, because that's not our style.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of pushback, you know, back and forth. But at the end of the day, like, you also feel like, you know, you're going to change his, literally, it's going to change his vision. He's trying to do something here. And yes, you know, maybe you should. I personally think that maybe, like, certain things that have happened afterwards are probably not really moving forward all that much. But, you know, for the period of Tree of Life, it happened the way it needed to happen. I don't know that I would change anything.
I think the consensus, my personal opinion, most everybody I know, is that Tree of Life is a form of the film that is definitely one of the high marks of 21st century cinema. No question. But I don't think that was true because it wasn't.
Well, I don't either, but I, you know. But again, you've got to believe. Have I seen which one?
Have you seen
Night of Cups or the other one? No. I've seen bits of them, just, you know. But I, you know, Terry and I are, you know, good friends, but I don't go down there all the time and look over his shoulder and see what he's doing. I mean, I feel really, honestly, sincerely close to him, but I, you know, it's like, there was a reason why we didn't go on after Tree of Life. It just was like, that was a great moment, and he needed to move on in a different way, and so did we, you know, kind of.
What happened to the IMAX thing about
it's still happening. It's still happening, yeah. No, he's still working on it. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So we've been, I'm a producer on it, and Brad and DG.
When it comes out in limited IMAX format, it'll be produced by Soul Paul.
Yeah, because we were all part of that process through Tree of Life, and then, you know, have continued throughout. There's other people as well, but there's other people as well who have been involved since. But
there was a year and a half ago, somebody sued him and said, "Where's the movie?" And I don't know what happened. That was dismissed or something.
Yeah, I don't know what happened either, to be honest.
That's been like 3 years.
That's Terry. I mean, if there weren't, like, personalities like that, life would be very boring. And I'm not saying everybody should be that. That's another one of those things. It's like, that doesn't mean I condone it or think that everybody should go out and do that kind of thing. All I mean is that he really is doing it from a sincere place. He's not doing it to mess with people or to show that he's tougher or something like that. Yeah, I really feel that he's on a journey. That doesn't mean that everybody wants to go on the journey with him. But, you know, he's got to make his own decisions in that regard.
Well, being an artist of the first order as you are, you know that the whole key to a lot of it, especially if you're writing from some personal place of your own, is how naked, how honest can you be about who you are, who you have been, where you're going. To the Wonder was a large part of his own life. But he shrouded it in ambiguity and as little dialogue as possible. So he really wasn't being that honest with the audience about his own history.
But he doesn't have an obligation to do that.
Artists do.
No, well, he is. He's doing the best he can. We don't always succeed in everything, you know. It's like, I'm just telling you that it's always a sincere effort. It's not, like, always successful, and it's not always palatable or something that people want to see, but... And you could say it's irresponsible for somebody to take millions of dollars and be on this kind of personal journey. But he's doing it legitimately, and if somebody's willing to give him the money, then I guess that's okay, you know, because he really is on that journey. I would not defend, I don't defend everybody like that. I mean, clearly, film is a collaborative medium, and it really is important that a producer pushes back or argues or like, and because, you know, obviously directors are not always right, and even if they're on a personal journey, that doesn't make them right, you know. It still has to be a collaborative thing. And I totally believe in that, and definitely have been engaged in that, you know, as a producer on other projects, and want that on like Love and Mercy or something. I thought I want people to push back, or on the next films, it's like you got to have a producer to push back. It can't be me, you know, fighting with myself all the time.
Because
I'm a director, and when I'm in the director chair, I'm fighting for the film or for my vision of the film, and somebody needs to fight me back. That's what makes it healthy. You know, otherwise, I'll throw off in some self.
What was the deal with Brian canceling his European tour?
I don't know.
He said, because I want to stay here and support Love and Mercy.
I don't know. There was no story that I'm aware of, or no, you know, secret story or anything like that.
That is a really great show, I'm going to tell you. Yeah. I had a better time at that Greek. I mean, last night was wonderful too, but somehow it sounded better at the Greek. You know,
right. I missed that one, unfortunately, Greek one. But last night was just I mean, because I've seen, obviously, Brian so many times, and to see him so relaxed and animated, even though people who saw him that have never seen him might not think he was not animated. For Brian, that was animated. And he was in a great mood. You can tell emotionally he was.
Have you ever happened to see Frank Sinatra, see a film of his performance?
I saw one of his performances at the very end.
I saw him in Naples. Same year I saw him. He does that same type of thing. He uses hand gestures to kind of act out. That's what Brian was kind of. I wonder if that was an influence.
Yeah, I think, I don't know.
It's like somebody said, you gotta act it.
Yeah.
Just sing it.
And it seems very awkward, but cute, and whatever. Because again, you know, for different reasons, but that's a guy who's just doing it. He's not trying to pose or trying to, like, sometimes when he does those hand movements, I'm sure somebody said, you should move around more. And so he thinks, oh, maybe I should move around more. But you know what I mean? Like, he's an authentic guy. He's not posing. He's not. And I think that's the coolest thing. Again, there's a difference between being authentic and pandering to somebody who's just kind of like doing it. But I like the authenticity.
So you must be investing in the next project. What's the next thing you're going to direct? You must be looking at something.
We've been working on a project, but you know, it's, there's actually a couple things on the table right now, which is nice. Something for the spring, but we're kind of wrestling with budget. As always, in cash.
The natural thing is, let's have him do another music biography, or and you know, stay away from that. Right? You got to do something else.
I mean, I love music, so it's always tempting a little bit when somebody says, "Why? How about this or how about that?" You know, but no, you know, obviously, trying to develop myself as a director. Going back there wouldn't be the best move. It'd have to be something extraordinarily different or something. Otherwise. And so everything that's on the table is, you know, kind of either more serious. Or I guess what I'm looking for is something that allows that kind of freedom in the sense of trying new things and, you know, developing textures. And
has anybody ever just put this on in front of you as a kind of a mom and the papa's movie about all that tumult of those 2 years, a year and a half?
No. I actually don't know that. I was a Mamas and Papas fan, but I wasn't, not enough to know their backstory. What was
the thing about that?
No.
The personal relationships, cheating on each other, affairs, that kind of, a lot of that. And all within like a year and a half, producer Don Mercier, who was sitting there right next to me last night, he was telling me about the right situation. And she's the only one left, Michelle Phillips. She's in, lives in plastic surgeon down in Beverly Wood, but she's, I don't know what the right situation is to use it for anything that has been something that he thinks would be, and he's struck me with a good idea. Do a James Bond film? What's your next?
It's the one that's kind of I'm most passionate about is a little, I suppose, darker and more serious. But it's, it's actually about war, the impact of war on an individual. But it's quite a different take. So I'll tell you more when I can. But I always hate to.
PTSD movie?
Kind of, yeah. Not kind of, yeah. But. So just trying to get that right, see if we can do it right, and but there's a couple other things that are interesting as well, so it's always in that.
Are you a fan of Coming Home, Al Ashby's Coming
Home?
Great PTSD right there.
We'll see. I mean, I'm excited, but it's hard to also go to these events like the Brian Wilson thing, and because it was such a special film and a special experience that you're kind of worried about the next one. Is it going to be, how's it going to compare? Really, that's a great thing. But so what do you think about the campaign, or what should we do? Seek your advice.
Well, I think there was last summer an Academy screening, right?
Yeah.
I think they should do one more now that the consciousness is starting to finally kick in because people know about it. It's filmed in, as you say, it's not just like people love it. So I think maybe one more of those.
Just trying to get it seen more.
Academy membership, mainstream Academy membership, many of whom I know personally, I just find it's just something, wonderful and electric that happens at a good festival when people are open and they respond and they give something at the film camera. It's like a great interview. And then you bring it back here and you show it to the Academy membership, and they're kind of like, slumping in their seat. I liked it. I don't know what it takes to wake people up to really good stuff. That's the whole thing. But one of those is good. Because it seems like during the season, you got to have one of those Academy screenings. It's like maybe, the body and Clyde model, warm base. Let's go back and do it again. And then finally connect.
So what do you mean? What happened there?
Well, the first run was, specialist and not very impressive to anybody, especially Warren Buffett. And he went back to Jack Warner and said, we got to re-release it. So I know that re-releasing is pointless with Blu-ray and streaming, but, you're doing it with all the press and everything. It's just that maybe if the Academy had one more Academy screening with a, party downstairs.
Going to be talking about it, but I'm not claiming to be any expert on all of that. So it's good to get some views on it.
It's Love and Mercy and Mad Max Fury Road. Those are the two from the earlier part of the year that demand being looked at and being in the conversation.
Are they doing a big thing for Mad Max?
I just saw a piece about a single trade ad, but it's more in the way of a road. They don't seem to be making a huge effort because they probably have accepted that most people, at least in the Guild and the Academy, probably see it as a very good action film. Let it go with that. Beautifully filmed action film.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Made by a 72-year-old.
Gives me hope that I have some years left.
Who's 77? Is it Redford? In the past, it was like, who was prolific in their later years, like Louis Buñuel? Mm-hmm. But it's the norm these days for people in the 70s, 80s. Great.
Yeah. Well, maybe I can achieve something. I waited too long or whatever, but try to come on strong later in the end.
That's why I mentioned the drinking last night because, I take back myself 3 years now, 2.5, almost 3 years. the greatest thing.
That's great. Yeah.
Energy-wise.
Yeah. That's cool.
Control, sense control, clarity.
Congratulations.
And I wasn't throwing it down big time. I was just, you know, nice pleasant glass of wine or two in the evening.
Yeah.
And it didn't feel like a problem at all. I just felt, I'll give it a shot, see what it's like. Pretty nice.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I definitely feel that way, that, you know, even when you just, because of situation, don't do it for a few days, it's
yeah.
like, oh, wow, there is kind of a freshness or a clarity.
Only tough part being when you go to parties the first year, like, geez, I'm not having as much fun here, you know, and I'm not laughing.
Uh-huh.
Get past that.
Gotta find the humor there again. Without the help, without the assistance.
Right.
It's gotta be there. So.
All right, well, this is great. I'm very sorry again. But
no,
we got it. We got it. Could I get something? What's your best side? Can I get a shot?
Oh, sure. I don't know what my best side is. What is my best side? Just my. I think it's probably this. Or do you want me to stand up, or what? Or we can go out?
Definitely not too light in the background, because that'll make you look shadowy. So let's see what this is like. It's not too bad here. A little shadowy. Okay, that's good. That's good. But I gotta get you. Let me try it. Let me just sit here for a second.
This still counts.
Excellent. Perfect. This is it. Okay. 1, 2, 3. Perfect. Excellent. Thank you, man.
Thank you
very much for your time.
Thank you.
I hope to see the other parents in Malmö Film once. Sometimes.
Yeah, me too. We can see it together. I'm anxious to see it.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, you got this. Jeff.
Oh, good point. Excellent. I agree. All right.